for Social Workers on the Run, brought to you by a bunch of social workers from Griffith University in Australia. I'm Tricia Fronick, one of that bunch, and we're just basically really glad you found us. So, happy listening. It's been estimated that almost a million children have been adopted internationally since the 1950s, predominantly to countries in North America, Europe and Australia. Most media interest centres on celebrity adoptions and popular notions of child rescue, and it's pretty much a contested area. But there is little media attention on inter-country adoption research. Today is the first in a series of podcasts on inter-country adoption, and I'm talking to Associate Professor Kathleen Jarsuk-Berquist from the University of Nevada. I interviewed Kathleen in Canada at the International Adoption Summit hosted by the University of Waterloo. Welcome, Kathleen. It's wonderful to have this opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you.
Well, it's been an exciting conference and enjoyable few days. It's nice to meet everyone and put names to faces.
Absolutely.
Kathleen, I'm not sure how much people do know about inter-country adoption. Mm-hmm. Where did it all begin?
Well, inter-country adoption, I think in earnest, began after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Following World War II, there were children brought from Europe to the United States and Canada, and also from Japan. But the numbers were pretty small. And so really when we think about the real significant first wave of inter-country adoption, and especially to the United States, it came from Korea in 1954, which is when the start began, and continues to today.
Okay, so have there been many children adopted internationally?
The estimates for children adopted from Korea has ranged, but, you know, it estimates range from 150,000 to 200,000 children that have been adopted out from Korea all over Europe and the United States and Canada and Australia. And of course, as we go through our different iterations of inter-country adoption, there's waves and ebbs, and the descending countries change from year to year. We know that there have been very many adoptions from Guatemala and from China and Russia. So certainly the face of adoption has changed over the years.
Are there particular influences that determine that those patterns?
Sure. What we do know about inter-country adoption is that they typically follow specific social, political, environmental, or economic upheavals in the country of origin, whether it's conflicts, armed conflicts, or if it's natural disasters, as in the tsunamis and Haiti. And so there's always something that creates a vulnerability in the country of origin.
You've recently done some work on Haiti, which is very interesting. What happened in Haiti?
Well, you know, my primary work has been focusing on adoption from Asia. But I think in order to really understand the full scope of adoption, you have to look at all the different country experiences. And one of the things that I found particularly interesting is how we as a national community respond to disasters. And much of inter-country adoption starts from crises, right? And so in Haiti is a very good example of that because there was this the sense of a need to rescue, and that is a very common thread and theme. And one of the things after the crisis in Haiti, there was this international call for, as there has been after many disasters and many armed conflicts, is this call to rescue children and people wanting to open their arms in their homes, which is a fantastic thing, right? But what we've learned from past experience and that because of The Hague, there has been caution put in place. You know, the sensibility tends to be more that we need to really think about what's in the best interest of children from a long-term perspective and not just immediate reaction to a crisis. And so there's been a lot of conflict about what would be the right response. I know that in Haiti, the international community sort of thanked people for their generosity, but wanted to ask families to be patient and to allow children to get registered and allow them to get reunited with family and get into safe places before we even consider adoption and removing children. But of course, there were instances where children were removed. And so, you know, the debate is still out about whether that was in the best interest of children, depending on the individual circumstances.
So did people actually go in and take children out of the country, or did agencies take children out of the country?
Well, there were a couple reported incidences. You know, in two cases, there were airlifts of children. One happened, and let me think about this. One happened right after, or excuse me, the morning of the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Napolitano from the United States, declared an exception for immigration purposes for children that were already in the pipeline to be adopted. And then also there was this sort of loophole which was created for other children that were, for humanitarian reasons, could be evacuated. And so there were two airlifts that occurred, one that occurred before she made that announcement. So the question about whether that was a legitimate airlift and whether it was, you know, legal and condoned is questionable. And then the second one, certainly there were children that were brought out after she made that exception.
How long after the disaster was that announcement?
It was within 6 or 7 days. It was
very quickly,
yes. And then, of course, there was the very highly publicized case where Laura Silsby's group tried to transport children across out of country to the DR, to the Dominican Republic, and they didn't have papers, and so there was an arrest, and yeah.
So was that to try to circumnavigate the system?
Well, you know, I mean, the group would tell you no, and that they just simply wanted to get children out of a disaster zone. And their intentions were not necessarily at that point to place children for adoption. So, you know, I think that they felt that the issue was not that they were trying to take children out for the purpose of adoption. They were merely trying to get them to a safe place. Mm-hmm. But regardless, they didn't have the right paperwork in order to do that. And so Haiti's laws require that any adoptions of children occur within country. Of course, often as we see in disasters, you know, what is the norm is often reconsidered.
It's so the urgency comes into people's thinking.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Some of the rules go out the window at that time.
Right, which is what creates this quandary for us, you know, as practitioners, but also as people that consider policy. What is the appropriate response to when we see a crisis, right? And that's sort of the purpose of the conference that we've been at this weekend, right?
I found it very interesting that it was considered a crisis and there was a sense of urgency, but it was actually only children in the pipeline for adoption that were flown out.
Right. And so that raises for me the questions about, you know, when you think about it, certainly the United States, and I'll speak for the United States, has the sense of responsibility and sense of, and we tend to respond to people in need globally, right? Mm-hmm. But sort of the analysis for that for me is when we have a vested interest, the stakes get higher. And I think for these children, there is almost this sense that those are our children, therefore we have this responsibility to take them to safety. So is the question really about child welfare generally, or is it about because we had this legal and financial and sort of personal connection to these children, therefore they were much more, it was much more salient and important to get those children out because they had parents waiting or prospective adoptive parents waiting.
And it seems to me that might be at odds with some of the literature on psychosocial care post-disaster.
Right.
That indicates that communities need some time healing and maintaining their connection after a disaster.
Sure. What we know from trauma studies is that one of the best things to do for children or for families or anybody in crisis is to lower the amount of dissonance that's created, right? Mm-hmm. And so the disaster itself creates that dissonance. But what helps people heal, what we know from the research, and decrease the amount of trauma is when they can be around surroundings that are similar. Because if you think about any stressful situation, the less transition and the more stability you can create, the greater chances of recovery or quicker recovery, mm-hmm. right? And so we do know that if you remove children, not they experience the trauma of the natural disaster, then they experience the trauma of being separated and being displaced and all those layers that exist. So the question is, which puts into question the practice of removing children from their country of origin and their communities of origin.
And this has some history, doesn't it? Because it leads back to some earlier work that you've done on Operation Baby Lift,
right.
which is also of interest to Australian listeners, because that's when we really became involved in right. inter-country adoption in 1975
right.
from that baby lift. Okay. So what are your views? Well, tell us about the baby lift. Let's start with that.
Right. Well, in April of 1975, as it became more and more clear, apparent, that Saigon was going to fall, the mm-hmm. U.S. government, President Ford at that time, committed $2 million for 30 baby airlifts, right? And so there were estimates of 2.5, I think, to 3,000 children that were removed from Vietnam through the airlifts within less than a month's time. Mm-hmm. And so the conventional wisdom at that time, and again, it's when you're in a crisis, you just sort of do what you think you can do, which is best at that moment. But so our lessons learned from that was that in that particular incident, not all those children were in fact orphans. And it became to the public and to the government's awareness through the Vietnamese American community, who, when they helped with the children, realized that some of these children had intact families in Vietnam. They'd been separated, and that's what happens in crisis. You know, people get separated, and so following the airlift, there were lawsuits that occurred trying to redress that issue. And of course, as social workers, we know that whenever you are dealing with children, there's this rush against time, because the longer that a child lingers either in care or separated from their family of origin, children, unlike other issues, you have to attend to it in a timely manner, or to them in a timely manner. So, you know, we have a lot of lessons that we could and should have learned from Vietnam, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure that the current, you know, the Hague Convention and or any of our other ways of thinking about it truly address that. And I think the fact that as a strength-based field, you know, we really are about preserving families, and we're really about thinking about the best interest of the family, not necessarily the best interest of parents that would like to save children. Mm-hmm. And so it creates this tension.
Mm-hmm. And it's very much, or it seems to be very much focused on individual children and adoptive parents.
Right.
And I tend to think the voice of birth parents sometimes are a bit invisible in
Absolutely.
This crisis.
Absolutely. And one of the things that, you know, and I'm just, I can't really speak to Haiti because I haven't done enough research mm. in Haiti to understand this, but I do know that in Vietnam, there is this, and in a lot of Asian countries, there's a sense that when you take your child and allow them to be in somebody else's care, and of course, this is not necessarily relevant for Vietnam in general, as far as the airlift, but often when you put children in care, does it mean, from a cultural perspective, that you're relinquishing all your legal and familial rights to that child? You're just saying, let me allow you to take care of my child because I can't do it right now. But that doesn't mean I want to relinquish my rights to that child. And that, in of itself, in the context of inter-country adoption, is a little bit concerning, because we're applying a Western notion of, if you leave your children for more than X amount of days, therefore you're relinquishing all your rights to your child. Mm-hmm.
Because as social workers know, I suppose, that in many different cultures there's many different definitions of family and
Absolutely.
What family actually entails. So
Absolutely.
So from what you're saying, parents may often leave their children with extended family under particular circumstances and not feel that that was unusual.
Right. Or any intent necessarily to give up their legal familial rights to that
yes.
child.
Right. So there is an imbalance,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
mm-hmm.
And a lack of understanding perhaps of the full implications of what adoption means.
I think so. And so I think one of the critiques that certainly I hear is that when we say things like that, we're sort of saying that intercountry adoption isn't appropriate, and that's definitely not what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. As an intercountry adoptee myself and also an adoptive parent of a child from Korea, I believe that intercountry adoption can be an appropriate response. But for me, it's about backing up and looking at the big picture as opposed to my individual investment in the issue. I mean, that's a difficult thing to do, you know.
Has it been difficult having that personal history, being an adoptee, being an adoptive parent and working in this field?
You know, I think that the challenge, I think, as a researcher, as you know, is walking a line where you sort of have to talk to what the research is telling us, but still not alienating any one community. And that's always a very precarious walk because, you know, and I think at some level being an adoptive parent gives me some authority to be critical because I'm not just somebody sitting on the fence and saying I've never experienced that and so therefore you don't know what you're talking about, right? So I think in a way it's been helpful, but in another way, from a personal perspective, I've had to sort of compartmentalize a little bit, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Adoptees, if we look at adoption from Korea, that began during the Korean War, really. So now that there is a large community of adoptees around the world and they've formed very strong connections as a community.
Absolutely.
Yeah, would you like to tell us a bit about that?
One of the things that... this is sort of my perspective of Korean adoption from a sort of cultural perspective is that when Korean adoption first began, of course, there was this sort of assumption, and it began as it did in Vietnam, largely with Amerasian children, this push to save the Amerasian children that were culturally sort of marginalized, right, in their country of origin. And so there was this perspective that adoptees would leave their country of origin and not come back. And from a social work perspective, the implications of that have been astounding because what has happened and was unanticipated was that their Korean adoptees have come back in waves. Thousands and thousands of Korean adoptees come to Korea every summer wanting to look at their files, and Korea was not prepared for that. And so my hope is that other countries will learn from our experience because we are the oldest and most established intercountry adoption program. And so... But what is in the absence of good post-adopt services, there have been informal communities developed among adoptees, and it's a pretty tight community. And the internet has made that much more feasible. It's something. There's something really surreal and sort of exciting when you meet adoptees from Denmark and from Sweden and from France. And you know, we may not speak the same language, but at some point we have a commonality that is goes beyond language, right?
And I get a very strong sense that it is a community, mm-hmm. it is a family, mm-hmm. and there's very, very strong connections there.
But having said that, we're also going through our growing pains as a family. Yeah. You think about family systems, right? You know, there are sort of these alliances and these sort of that are occurring within the community in conflicts as well, so... Yeah.
In Australia, the media often promotes intercountry adoption as a totally positive experience. And I suppose as social workers, we know that's not always the case. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, as social work practitioners, what are the most important things that we should know about?
You know, I think one of the most important things that social workers and adoptive parents can do for the children is to always remember that an adoptee comes with an entire history, and their life didn't begin when they hit their adoptive home or their receiving country. Mm-hmm. There is this sort of myth that I've encountered in the Chinese adoptive community. There is a story, a Chinese fable about the red thread, and I don't know if you've heard of that.
No, please tell
us. But basically what it is there is a folklore, a folktale from China that talks about a red thread connecting two people. And it was really based on a romantic story of saying when we were born, we were connected by a red thread, and it's for a man and a woman. And as they went through their life, the thread gets shorter and shorter and shorter until they meet. But the sort of the metaphor is that we were always meant to be together. It was just we had to find our path to each other through this red thread. We were always connected. Well, the Chinese adoptive community sort of co-opted that story and said, when you were born, you know, we were always meant to be mother and child, or parent and child, and it was just a matter of finding ourselves, each other.
So that's the story that adoptive parents are now
some of the adoptive parents have sort of co-opted that story and embraced that, and it's very romantic. But what's just disturbing to me, and I think it's sort of emblematic of that, is the complete removal of the birth mother and or the history before, and like everything, basically what it's saying, everything that you experienced until you met me was just a path to meet me as your birth mother, or as your adoptive mother. And it completely discounts the role of the birth parent, the culture and family of origin, the community of origin, and it really, I think, does a disservice to the children ultimately, because if that story is perpetuated within the family system, the adoptive family system, it's basically saying it doesn't give the child permission to own and to embrace and to have any kind of authority over their story pre-adoption.
Mm-hmm. And that's obviously very important for identity and understanding one's own history.
Sure. You know, and in the United States, the series Roots, you know, Alex Haley did the television series of Roots, looking at slavery and the origins of slaves, and from a very sort of empowering. And his statement was about how, which I think is very profound, he said there's something that is so profoundly embedded in our DNA around identity that is a common experience for all human beings. Mm-hmm. And I think he's absolutely right, you know, and how that plays out. And so I guess what I'm saying is that in any adoption situation, identity, whether it children are able to articulate at any specific developmental age, is an important part of who they are. And so we need to be able to always, as social workers, help parents to understand that, because it can be very threatening to adoptive parents. Mm-hmm. And also to help adoptees to own that and to be comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm. And it's very complex, and adoptees react in very different ways.
Oh, absolutely!
Don't they?
Oh, absolutely! Mm-hmm. You find adoptees responding to one, the issues of adoption, and two, the issues of race and ethnicity and culture, very, very different. But yet, you know, of course, there's individual differences, but we're looking at overarching trends, right, and developmental, what is normal developmentally. And so, what we do know is that even if an individual adoptee deals with these issues differently at different points in their life, they will, at some point in their life, it'll become salient. Mm-hmm. You know, and so the question is when, right? And that can vary greatly from individual to individual.
Does it have any connection to having a happy adoptive home?
Well, that's a $50 million question, right? Because there is this sort of belief that the adoptees that are unhappy are the ones that make most of the noise, and the sort of the angry adoptee. And I think about that often when you look at adoption researchers that critique. Mm. And sometimes I think that infantilized. I don't know if I'm saying it right, but really saying, oh, they're working out their issues through their research. Mm. You know, and that's an interesting. But I also think that because a lot of the researchers are also adoptive parents, there is that tension there. Mm. Yeah.
I have noticed in the adoption research field that there can be polarizations, and people do tend to be labeled as anti-adoption or pro-adoption, and also labeled according to views that are expressed, or findings really, of research.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And being critical of processes can sometimes be interpreted as anti-adoption.
Absolutely. Mm. It's unfortunate, because ultimately we need all of these perspectives in order to make informed decisions as far as policy and whatnot.
Yeah. What do policymakers need to know, do you think?
Mm. I think that's a really good question. For me, it's about protecting children, right? And making decisions that are in the best interest of children. But the problem with that kind of amorphous language is that everybody will say our concerns are the best interests of the children, protecting children. Mm-hmm. And so then you get this, you come in a bypass, right? Mm-hmm. But I think...
And that's where people conflict, isn't yes. it, about what is in the best right. interests of children.
Yeah, and then there tends to be at some point some moral posturing about who really has that perspective, right? Mm-hmm. But for me, it's... I think we make policy not for today, but for tomorrow, mm-hmm. right? Because, and so what I would like policymakers to do is to think about not in the moment, but how do we set policies that will ensure future, and impact future practices, informed practice, right? Mm-hmm. Because when we think about just in the present, it's very short-sighted. And we talked about the whole issue about baby lifts and airlifts, right? Because I don't know that the research or the literature supports that airlifts are in the best interest of children. And so if we know that, then how do we think about that? Because it's going to happen again and again and again. How do we think about ways that we can respond in disaster situations? You know, I think that in a lot of our situations where we feel the need to rescue children, it's because we don't have the mechanisms in place to appropriately respond to the community as a whole in a crisis. And so the short-term reaction is, well, we'll just pull people to safety, as opposed to having a comprehensive way to respond.
I think in countries like Australia, often the only voice that we hear in terms of policy development are the voices of people wanting to adopt children. And what's happening in the sending countries seems very far away. And I'm not convinced those messages get through sometimes.
Absolutely. You know, I thought that was really interesting, you know, with the conference that we were at this weekend. It was noted that there was not enough participation from sending countries. And my sort of question in the back of my head was, why aren't we doing this in sending countries, mm-hmm. not in receiving countries? Because really, they're the ones that need to be at the table. And it's true with the way that we approach most things. We come from a Western perspective, and we do what we think, what is comfortable for us, as opposed to really going to where the solutions should be coming from, right? Because mm-hmm. we can mm-hmm. sit here and come up with solutions for other countries, but the reality is that they need to come from their own countries. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a lot of ethical issues, mm-hmm. isn't it? The deeper you dig mm-hmm. into inter-country adoption, mm-hmm. the more complex it seems to become.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is interesting that we don't hear enough of the voice of sending countries.
Yeah, and I... When you look at the critiques of The Hague, and you know that, and we've been slamming it all weekend, but one of the critiques is that when you say you have to have a central authority yeah. in order to play with us,
yeah. Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of resources that need to be in place, yeah. and
that's the Hague Convention on
inter-country adoption, right? Yeah. Sorry. So when you talk about just that in general, right? Saying part of the Hague Convention, which is created to at some level control inter-country adoption, you have to have a central authority. And so for countries that are administratively pretty tight, it's a pretty simple thing to do. But when you deal with countries of origin, which often aren't, and are often struggling with basic, mm-hmm. you know, getting basic services mm-hmm. for their people, and then saying you have to create this bureaucracy, I mean, to me, it's all part of the same problem, is that as Westerners, we have these expectations that are imposed on other folks, mm-hmm. right? Yeah.
So social workers do work in sending countries,
mm-hmm.
In receiving countries,
mm-hmm.
often assessing prospective parents, providing pre- and post-adoption support.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a bit about some of those roles?
Well, my experience as far as sending countries has been limited to China and to Korea.
Yeah.
And having visited the agencies in Korea, I think there's several things. One of the things is that often in the sending countries, the state of the art of social work is very in very early stages.
Mm-hmm.
There are very few schools of social work. A lot of the folks that are doing the casework don't have social work backgrounds. And And I know that in Korea, they're very overwhelmed, often, as far as their caseloads are concerned. Mm-hmm. And again, as I had mentioned earlier, there was this, getting children adopted is one piece, then dealing with the post-adoption needs is another. And the agencies are often ill-equipped to do that. And then the question is, where does that funding come from to do the post-adopt services as well, right? So one of the things that we struggle with in dealing with Korea, I think, is the whole issues of transparency. Because transparency, what we consider an open adoption in the United States is very different than what they consider open adoption in Korea. Open adoption in the United States means birth parents and adoptive parents know each other and there's open communication. If you go to Korea, open adoption, Korea is telling the kid that they're adopted, which is a very different kind of notion, right? So the roles, I think, of social workers are very different. They're very about preserving and protecting the files and the, as they should, the privacy of the birth parents. I think in the United States, the role of social workers is really about preparing parents and making, I guess we're supposed to be gatekeepers. I don't know how much gatekeeping happens. And so in the absence of gatekeeping, I would love to see much better preparation of adoptive parents. Mm-hmm. Because there is this sort of, and I encounter this all the time, this notion that all you need is to love a child, and I just want a child, I don't care how the child comes to me. And adopting internationally or interracially is a much huger commitment than just loving a child. It requires certain actual skills that are above and beyond that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that all social workers get that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So training in this area is fairly important.
Absolutely.
In professional development.
Unfortunately, training for social workers, yeah. But also for parents.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, parents, and this is what social workers have to be cognizant of, is that when parents are in that place, they're waiting for a child, they'll sit in the classes, and you can see they're checked out, and they're like, oh, why do I have to do this? And I think that's why it's so important for us as social workers to really engage parents and try to help them develop skills. Mm-hmm.
Final word, is there mm-hmm. anything finally any particular issue you'd like to raise? What do we need to hear?
What do we need to hear? Well, I don't know what we need to hear, but I can tell you what my area of research that I'm sort of struggling with right now, questions that I'm struggling right now is the intersections of inter-country adoption and human trafficking. Mm-hmm. And I know that there's been some work done around that, around child laundering. David Smolin talks about child laundering a lot. And from the United States perspective, I'm always curious, because while the Hague and also the CRC talk about
the Convention on the Rights of the Child.
Correct, the Convention on the Rights of the Child actually use the language, the words trafficking, right? But when you look at the legislation in the United States, they have what they call the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which was passed in 2000, and they define trafficking. Nowhere in there could inter-country adoption be fit, because the way that they define it. And so that's sort of my focus is sort of thinking about that. What does that mean? Because certainly we know that children are being placed, are being bought and sold, and are being laundered, if not trafficked. And so I'm sort of looking from a legislative and legal perspective how that comes together.
And that's a side we don't often hear about. We hear about the good things in inter-country adoption, but we only tend to hear about those things or about child trafficking briefly when there's some sort of scandal. And there's certainly been issues in Australia recently with regards to adoption from India.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm. And I see a kind of a spectrum issue. Yeah. In the worst case scenario, children are trafficked. In the best case scenario, they're put in... Well, in the best case scenario, there's family reunification in the country of origin, and somewhere in between intercultural adoption fits. And where it does, I'm not quite sure. So,
thank you so much. That has been really interesting, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kelly. Hey, fellas, would you say something good? I don't know what it's called, but I think you would. It goes.